This recording has been released into the public domain by the Bahnsen Institute, where we aim to bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ.
Okay, now the question that I put up here on the board obviously then becomes crucial. How do you discern God's will for the state? And I'm going to get into that and survey a good number, maybe, about eight different positions. I haven't counted them up. But I'm going to try to give you a survey of that and reactions as well. But before we get into that, which will take the rest of our time, and probably sometime Thursday as well now, I want to give you plenty of opportunity to discuss what I was giving to you in the last 15 minutes or so of our previous session. So who would like to be first? Yes.
Yeah, I'd like to ask a question in reference to what you just mentioned before the vote, that interrogation. That is, it is true that, you know, there is a dilemma behind the question of whether or not God's given to the state the right to levy equality, then how would we really know what aspect of God's justice involves equality levying activities of the state? In other words, if we as believers are called to call the state to repentance, and to a stewardly like modality or motif in terms of its sphere of power.
Okay? Right.
Keeping it in the sphere.
Yeah, I think.
How do you deal with that?
I think that the thing that has to be observed is that there's no injunction in the Bible given to the state to make people equal, economically equal. It does say do not oppress the poor, the widow, the orphan, fatherless, what have you. However, oppressing these people, taking advantage of them in society, or not giving them justice in court, is much different than equalizing their economic power with that of somebody else. So that if somebody cannot adduce a biblical teaching, a biblical text of whatever length, I don't mean it has to be a proof text in one sentence, but some biblical justification for the equalizing activity of the state, then we would say we don't even have to worry about what amounts to equalizing, because that isn't a goal, that isn't an ideal for the state. What is an ideal is justice. That is to say, people not interfering with the rights of others. So that when a woman is raped, of course, her rights have been violated. When I'm stolen from, my rights are violated. When I'm murdered, then my rights have been violated. So forth and so on. So the state's got to preserve rights. And so the issue becomes, as I was asked right before we start, well, are there benefit rights? And I really think that people would be hard-pressed to prove that the poor can go to the rich and say, I have a right to your money. Now, in the Church of Jesus Christ, we can preach because of the duty of charity that people in the church, God's people, have the duty to support the poor. And I don't hide the fact that I preach that, and I think it's very important. And if the poor are going to be adequately taken care of, I think it has to be by God's people and not by the state. But nevertheless, that duty arises because we are Christians, and this is charity. But remember that in its nature as charity, it cannot be constrained by the recipient of the charity. Now, charity, the word charity... Well, I'm giving you my welfare lecture. I'm going to wait on this. Okay.
Could you go back to the original question I asked and proceed to give a definition of your state? I think that's true.
It's going to come up here. When I said I was going to answer it tonight, so you keep thinking you're being put off.
It's not a good place for it, given some of the things you've already said.
It's not?
Well, this is, I'm giving you my opinion.
Okay.
I just wondered if you could address it. In the context of, for instance, the business of, say, the building of roads, we talked about roads, in your view, being a direct service. Well, when you were advancing the critique that you were going to clear to Richie for me, I really struggled with that because, first of all, I didn't know what you were referring to as a state. I frankly don't know what paradigm you're functioning in when you talk about state.
Okay.
And I think that's crucial to any argument that would deal with the proper places.
Okay, now you're asking me for the proper function of the state or the nature of the state itself?
That's a good question. I think I'm asking for the nature of the state itself.
Okay, the state is an order of God's providence instituted as a result of the sin of man in order to preserve justice within human societies, having that power in virtue of its might in terms of the sword.
Sounds
what?
That's good, but it doesn't really hit the spot. You know,
okay.
In terms of what you brought up here with direct services, being the building of roads.
So. Okay, you want to know whether that is part of God's will for the state, don't you? It's not so much the nature of the state. You want to?
Well, I don't know. Okay. I mean, if we're stuck with your language, you know. I think that's what I'm having.
You're not. Propose an alternative.
Okay.
That's not a challenge. I'm just not sure what you're looking for.
Okay. For instance, you know, I'm functioning from convention simply, and that is some people talk about a modern industrial state. Some scholars who speak of the nation state cite a few, Dr. John Kenneth Galbraith, Dr. Kenneth Boulding, different economists who deal with the state from that vantage point. And it just seems to me that...
Do these people agree that the state has coercive power? And has this coercive power for the purpose of preserving rights? Yeah, they do, as a matter of fact. I've read both of them.
Yes.
And they both think that one of the rights that the state has to preserve are benefit rights.
Okay.
So again, I don't think it's so much you're looking for my view of the nature of the state. You're asking for my view of the proper function of the state, and I've given that.
I confess a language problem here, okay? That's precisely where I'm coming from. You know, as you taught, I've only seen this nebulous thing called state, and I didn't see it functioning within any of the paradigms I had personally had in contact with.
And well, that may be because it functions in all of them. I think I've given you such a common view of the state that it doesn't differentiate. See, the way I'm cutting the pie here is we all know that the state is a coercive power. Okay, so coercion is the nature of the state for the sake, not simply of self-aggrandizement, of course, for the sake of justice, for the sake of preservation of rights. Okay, and so the real hearty questions that divide men, it seems to me, are what are our rights? Okay, is it my right to have as much money as somebody else? Is it my right to have an education? Is it my right to have my body protected from assault? You know, what are my rights? Where do they begin and end? Now, you're right. I mean, in a sense, you're caught by my outlining of the course and categorizing it that way. But I don't believe I'm screening out any view or any question thereby. I'm simply saying that now we can focus on this point by asking, what are our rights? Now, I've said that we need to have a regulative principle. And I'm going immediately, as you can see, into the question, how do you discern God's will with respect to rights? How do you discern God's will for the state? And I'm going to give you, I think, more options than maybe you'd like to know about here. I'm trying to cover the field, but I don't know how else to do it. Somebody can say, well, if you believe that benefit rights are to be countenanced by the state and somebody else doesn't, then you have different views of the state in its very nature, then I'm willing to say that's fine if you want to use your language that way. And I don't believe in the industrial state, as John Kenneth Galbraith does. That's fine. But I can use his language. If he wants the word state, he can have the word state. Then we can make up a word for what I'm talking about. But as a Christian, it isn't a matter of words. It's a matter of concepts, duties that God has given. And has God given to any group of men the duty to collect taxes to do the following things? And you're going to have to answer that question whether you call that group of men the state or the industry or the military or what have you.
I agree with that, but we still have to deal with words. And that's kind of...
Yes. Some people may think I have too many words. I'm certainly dealing with words. What do you think is lack in my vocabulary?
Well, as you talked about the state, it seems to me that one thing that God would do that you didn't mention is to make sure we recognize where the paradigm of the state ended. I mean, we're talking about where it begins and how it extends. Well, I don't know if we're talking about a lot of its limitations.
Well, that's why I introduced the notion of a regulative principle, to regulate where the state goes and where it stops. So
let me give you an illustration. When you put up the characters V through K or whatever they were, it seemed to me that there are other things besides the state that would cause disparity between these people in terms of income levels or different.
I didn't talk about what caused the disparity. I talked about the state being used as a force of equalization.
Right, but I think when you talk about the state being used as a force of equalization, you got to deal with problems of disparity, too.
Why?
Oh, wow. I mean, that's a whole research project, you know, frankly, from my point of view.
Well, I mean, you say that as though there's something obvious about it. There must be some principle.
No, I wasn't trying to assume there's anything obvious about it. You know, I'm just saying that it seems to me to deal with a lot of the essence of what state is, one has to deal with what caused disparity.
Okay, look. Let's say we have poverty and disparity.
Yeah, right.
Okay, somebody can ask, what is the cause of poverty? Anybody who proposes a simple answer to that is probably a simpleton.
Right.
The cause of poverty is a research project that would take a long time. But you can also ask the question, what is the cure for this? You know, how should we deal with this? And that's what I'm saying. Is the state part of the cure of poverty? No matter what the causes are, causes may be A, B, C, who knows how many more causes. And the only way I think the state can be brought into a discussion of cause is if, as you're going down through these things, you come across one as a matter of fact in the whole list, it turns out the state has some blame for the poverty of men. I happen to think the state does. I'll give you one illustration. The state has minimum wage standards. Okay? And I understand the motivation for that. It's a noble motivation. The idea is that somebody's going to work, let's help him get enough so that it means something. But you see, the problem is that an employer looks at this person not in terms of what he needs, but in terms of what he is supplying to him. So that if there is, let's say that you have a dropout from high school who is fairly illiterate and doesn't have any skill, he doesn't have any plumbing skill, he doesn't have any time as an apprentice and all that. I mean, he's virtually, you know, without much benefit to an employer. But he says, look, I can use this man as a janitor. I can show him what it takes to do it. Granted, that's nothing attractive, but somebody's got to be a janitor. If he is willing to work for me, I'll pay him $2 an hour to be a janitor. Now the state comes along and says, hey, look, we care for this high school dropout who doesn't have any ability, and we think you ought to pay him $3.50 an hour. That's a minimum wage. You know what happens to that fellow? The employer says, well, he ain't worth $3.50 to me, and so he has to be dropped. And so in the name of giving him more money, the state gives him less. Isn't that ironic? Another illustration where the state tries to equalize things and lo and behold turns out favors one group over another. In the nature of the case, the free market, once you tamper with it, it's going to become unfair. So I believe you can list the state among some of the causes of poverty today. And to that degree, the state becomes the cure because it should get out of the marketplace. Okay? It should stop oppressing people by trying to favor one group over another. But for the most part, all I was saying in the last hour is that the state is not part of the cure, because then you have this idea of C going to the state, and B, and A, and Z, and everybody else. And then the question is, well, who really does have the right to demand of other people, or people in general, that they pay them, or give them education, or give them chocolate milkshakes, for all I know?
Well, I guess I agree with that. But for that reason, let me just say that I think the state is one of the B's, not the string. You know?
Say that again?
I think the state is one of the B's for that reason. I think maybe you're pointing to some of the things I've been unsettled about since you started.
The state is one of the B's?
It's one of the B's, you know, if you will. One of the B's
because it's not the string.
Oh, B's.
Yeah,
okay.
It's not the string. I think we've been referring to the state consistently as the string of why, you know, a lot of things are happening. And I'm
trying to find a way of agreeing, you know, with what the things you're saying, but I'm not understanding what you're saying now.
Oh, okay.
The bead and string metaphor is not mine, but it may be true and all that. In what way is the state the string in my approach?
Well, it seems to be like the substructure for a lot of the social and economic and other disparities that you spoke. I'm generalizing, of course, but I'm just wondering if...
Okay, I understand your metaphor. It seems to me that the people I'm arguing against have the state as the string. But I hold to the view of sphere sovereignty, although you'll see later I don't hold to it in a Doyeverdian fashion. I believe the state and the family and the church are different spheres. And I believe that, you see, what the state can do, the church cannot, and what the church can do, the state cannot. Okay? For instance, the church can preach the gospel. I don't believe the state can preach the gospel. I think that's absolutely wrong. For the state to preach the gospel or to require profession of faith of men. I think the church would be wrong not to require profession of faith in men to be members of the church. On the other hand, the state can execute people, but the church can't. Okay, now there are things the family can do that the church cannot and the state cannot. So I mean, it seems to me you have these different beads. But there are others who hold a view that says, among all of the different social groups, okay, the doctors, industry, the military, the church, the family, education, that the one thing that runs through all of this is what? The state. It seems to me that when that happens, that's called not the string, but the beast. That's the metaphor in the Bible. It's when the beast starts saying what you can do in medicine, what you can do in your home, what you can do in the marketplace, and it says you must do it according to its regulations rather than according to God's regulations. So I guess basically I understand your metaphor now, but I really don't believe, I want you to know from my heart, I don't believe the state's the string of society. Yeah. You know, beating everything together.
Conspiracy seems to exist to get to that place.
Oh, I think that's a very real tendency.
Your tendency, I saw.
Yeah. I'm hoping this class will resist that kind of thing. Okay, another question? Yeah.
The question I have is, you mentioned in Romans 13 that state is an order of coercion and of the sword. Maybe you handled this question prior to the time just auditing tonight, but can a Christian then be a member in the state and its political function, remembering the words of Jesus to Peter, put up the sword, those who take up the sword shall perish by the sword, and so forth. And the Pope's recent decision to tell people get out of politics, and so forth. If you care to comment on that, I'd appreciate it.
Sure. I think when Jesus told Peter to take up the sword, he was speaking to Peter as a representative of the apostles, and therefore of those who are foundational in the church of Jesus Christ. If you will, you get commentary on that when Paul says in 2 Corinthians chapter 10 that the weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh, they aren't carnal, but rather of the Spirit, and just for that reason they are powerful, for the overthrowing of every high thing exalted against the knowledge of God. And so Jesus is saying to the church, via Peter, if you will, Peter, put up your sword. My kingdom is not of this world, else would my servants fight. So I don't believe the kingdom of Jesus Christ advances by swords loud clashing or stir of rolling drums, but rather by deeds of love and mercy the heavenly kingdom comes, as the hymn says. Consequently, Jesus speaking to Peter to put up the sword doesn't say anything about whether Christians have the right to enter the service of the state. It simply says that the church does not have the right to use the sword, but the state has the right to do so. And the question is, can a person who is in the church operate in the state? And let's begin by looking at the Old Testament. When Daniel went into captivity in Babylon, you find that here's a godly man who God honors in the service even of a pagan state. Okay?
Under the coercion of that pagan state.
Oh, yeah, even under the coercion of that pagan state. Paul says of rulers that they are God's ministers. The language he uses is the same language used of a minister in the church. So there does seem to be a dignity about the position of rule in society called the state. However, that dignity is perverted when the minister of God becomes rather a master over all men and he becomes a beast. By the way, I should have added to my exposition earlier that the beast in Revelation, in terms of the mark of the beast, is given another title in 2 Thessalonians 2. I think all scholars, all conservative scholars, grant it's the same person. Again, whether future or past, I won't argue. And what is the name in 2 Thessalonians 2? The man of
lawlessness.
Okay, so you see the point. The regulative principle of the state, I believe, is the law of God. And the beast is precisely a man of lawlessness, the one who will not be governed by God's law.
If the church is not to have the power of coercion in the same manner that the state does, what about the statement of the apostles that will not submit to those areas in which the church is to have rightful dominion?
Give me an example.
Well, I'm sure there's many ways you're talking about the propriety of welfare and so forth. Maybe you're going to come to this, but if we're assuming about, if we're assuming that it involves a redistribution or in some way extending the financial assistance to people, what if the majority of the populace has no interest in of themselves contributing to the problems of others in that area?
Yeah. Well, if it's a matter of charity, then it's a matter of charity, not a matter of coercion. And so if the majority will not support the poor, then the poor will not be supported, short of the judgment of God giving us a state that does it because the church wasn't. I mean, I recognize that the state doing these things today is a judgment on the church. I said that earlier, because the church wasn't doing it. But if you live in a day in which men will not show goodwill toward others, then of course you live in a society that's not characterized by goodwill. I mean, we mustn't have the thought in mind that one way or another we're going to get the good done. Because it's not just the good that must be done, it must be done in a good way. And we must remember the end does not justify the means. And consequently, we may think we're going to help the poor by coercing people to pay up. But if we use evil to promote good, God doesn't honor the effort. And as a matter of fact, the good doesn't usually get done anyway. I think, first, the state is not charged to reflect the total character of God. Although I think you're right, you're on to a very important point when we see that moral duty is a reflection of God's character, and therefore a godly state is going to do its duties as given by God. However, you must remember that the character of God includes not simply his wrath and justice, but also his mercy and grace. Okay? And so, is the state an order of mercy and grace? Is it an order of redemption, if you will? Well, there's nothing in the Bible to indicate so. In fact, we get in the Bible a clear differentiation between the order of redemption, that is the international body of believers called the church, and the order of justice, which is an order of the sword. The church can't use the sword, the state must use the sword. And so there's clearly a difference between these two. But is one in the will of God, another outside the will of God? No, those are both part of the will of God. But that's just what we mean by the separation of church and state, that the church is supposed to be engaged in matters of welfare, charity, gospel, conversion, redemption, whereas the state's not dealing with redemption. The state is in the area of justice and the preservation of the created order, okay, over against the sinful tendencies of men. And so you're right, it reflects the character of God, that is, the state does. However, I wouldn't say that it reflects the whole character of God, because then the state could become all these other institutions. It could become education, it could become church, it could become all these things. But now, God progressively shows what a godly state is. Again, you're right there. In the Old Testament, however, I would be cautious. I wouldn't say that the Old Testament, as a matter of fact, shows us what a godly state is. It shows us what a godly state should be. But the Jews fell far short of being that. In fact, you'll see when Christ shows up as the king in the theocracy, they would have nothing to do with him. And he says, so the kingdom of God is taken from you and is given to a nation producing the fruits thereof. Okay, so in the Old Testament we see what ought to be. We also see the failure of God's people to be that. Okay, so it seems to me that what you're looking for is that the Old Testament gives us the model of a godly state in the theocracy. And the theocracy is, by its very definition, the rule of God. The rule of God. How would God have the state to be ruled? Well, this shows you this Old Testament pattern. And it's that pattern which we would like to see other nations imitate. Okay, I take it that that is the model, that is the goal for our political evangelism, is to bring states in line with the Old Testament theocratic conception. But now, all of a sudden, you're saying, wait a minute, we don't believe in a theocracy today, and that's because, we're getting back to this vocabulary thing, the word theocracy has probably a dozen different meanings that I can point to immediately. In my book, I go through 6, 7, 8 of them in the current literature. Theocracy is taken to mean a lot of different things, and I'm not endorsing every one of those conceptions of theocracy. What I mean by a theocracy is a state that does the will of God. Okay, and obviously we have to ask then, how do you discern what God's will is for the state over against for the family, for the church, and all the rest? And so, again, some of this is going to be relevant to our discussion once we get to it. Yes?
You alluded to the free market system. Do you view capitalism and democracy as ideals which can be found in the Bible, or can be...
It all depends on what you mean by, quote, free market, what you mean by capitalism. Okay? What is called capitalism today is, first of all, not the free market. Okay? Just a matter of, it's unfortunate, but we just have to recognize that capitalism is usually understood to be the way the United States was being run today. But see, the United States has protective tariffs. The United States has minimum wage laws. The United States has any number of things that favor monopolies. All sorts of tax loopholes for the rich and so forth. That's not capitalism. That's not the free market. That's not everybody, you know, having an equal stand an equal entrance into the marketplace and equal legal rights in the society. That is favoritism. Okay, now the problem is when people criticize the current American system of economic control and they use the title capitalism, they are condemning something which historically is not called capitalism. That would be called the intrusion of the state into the marketplace. But now you can say, well, then your concept of capitalism, if you mean by something good, is the free market. Well, even that has to be qualified, because even as the word theocracy and the word capitalism are being used very loosely for a lot of different things, the free market can mean a lot of different things too. And I don't believe in the free market. And that may surprise some people because they know I'm a capitalist, all right, in the traditional sense or in the biblical sense. I don't believe in the free market because I don't believe that anybody has the right to pander pornography. The free market, in the libertarian sense, says that the market's open to any product at any price, whoever wants to pay. I don't believe that people can put contracts out on the lives of other people. I don't believe the market's free to use that kind of commerce, you know, to say, well, how much will you pay to have me kill so-and-so, or to produce pornography, or to perform a homosexual act, or something like that? I don't believe the market's free, therefore. I believe the state can govern the market. The issue, then, is not free market, socialism, welfare, capitalism. The issue is, how do you discern God's will for the state? There was a reason why I put that up on the board, because it all comes back to this. What is the regulative principle for the state? I believe in the free market in the relative sense, but I don't believe the state should engage in economic redistribution. I don't believe the state should be an equalizing force in the market. I believe the state should protect everybody's entrance into the market and should honor contracts and that sort of thing. Should, if you will, enforce the Eighth Commandment against stealing and against breaking contracts and all the rest. But I do not believe that the state should allow just anything to take place in the market. I don't believe the state should allow people to sell snuff films, for instance. And I do believe that the Bible teaches something closer to capitalism than it does to socialism. Okay, I think that'll help answer your question. But when all the qualifications are built in, then it's far less than what it sounds like. I don't believe the state has the right to coerce welfare, and I don't believe that anybody has the right to nationalize industry, and I don't believe that all things are held in common. I believe in private property. So in that sense, in the most root sense, I'm a capitalist. I believe in free enterprise, and I believe in private property. But I don't believe in utterly free enterprise, and I don't believe that private property for the Christian is a justification for greed.
How would you dissect much of your views in terms of what you just said from the secularization of them? Namely, from them becoming a watered-down version of what the Republican Party platform might be.
Oh, my. How would I protect it?
I guess that's the whole course. But,
okay. In the first place, I have no control over what others will do with my views. Okay? I give my views and the principles behind them and the regulation of God's Word. Now, if somebody says, hey, I'm going to take most of this and forget the regulation of God's Word, then they've abused my views. But, I mean, there's nothing I can do about that any more than somebody who holds to Mark Haynes' view can keep people from taking it and calling it socialism when, as a matter of fact, he didn't mean by it socialism. Whereas this one deserves the imprimatur of Christ to 10%. What I'm saying is there's no reason why I have to choose the Democratic or the Republican platform. They can categorize their views in that package, in this package, but I'm going to do some weeding. Okay? So I'm going to come here and I'm going to weed out these things, and I'm not going to leave it just as the Republican Party platform. I'm going to take these things and bring them over. I'm going to do my best to not stand with the Republicans or the Democrats. Okay, but now the rubber hits the road. I've got to vote for one of them. Okay?
Yeah.
My own personal view is I'm going to promote all the things that I think God's law wants me to promote. But when it comes to voting, I am going to have to choose the man I think is probably going to get further down the road. Now, let me use a horrendous illustration. Now, I'm telling you, it's horrendous. Let us say that George Wallace is running for president again. As a matter of fact, George Wallace has a lot of these things that the Christian would agree with, but a lot of things that are just reprehensible. Okay? And he does. Did. Okay? Should I vote for George Wallace even though he has more elements in line with my view than the other fellow?
No.
Well, I can't wait for perfection.
For me, no.
I can't wait for perfection.
I mean, I'm not going to get somebody who agrees completely until I run for president. Okay? The only person I know who agrees with me completely is myself. Okay? But, on the other hand, there is something to be said for, well, Wallace only disagrees with me on 2 points, but as a matter of fact, his disagreement is so ugly and so unjust that if he were to ever do any of those things he wanted to do, I'd outweigh all the other things that I agree with him on. I may come to the conclusion I have to vote against George Wallace for that reason. On the other hand, I may say, well, those things are so ugly and so unjust that there's no way he's going to accomplish that. And so, I mean, he's safe in those areas. Congress is never going to let him get away with that kind of nonsense. And so in the areas where he's strong, I could vote for him. What I'm suggesting to you is the choice of a political candidate is not easy at all. It's not just looking at how many places I agree with him. It's also how strong is my agreement and disagreement in these areas. You've got to weigh this sort of thing, and then it always comes down to what? The lesser of two evils, right? Until we get a Christian political platform, it's always going to be the lesser of two evils. Because in the nature of the case, these are both humanist options. I agree with you. The rubber hits the road, though. The tendency is for Christians to say, well, this is the Christian platform, or this is the Christian platform. Okay? As Christians, do we believe in feeding the poor? Huh? Huh? Well, obviously the Democrats want to feed the poor. Well, the Democrats are Christians. No, no, as Christians, we believe in the free market. So the Republicans are Christians. I should tend to say that the free market and feeding the poor are both Christian options. I mean, both Christian duties, and therefore we're neither Republican or Democratic. But when you have to vote for a candidate, undoubtedly you'll vote for one in that party or the other party or one in the third party. Yeah.
Would you advocate a political party that found to stand on Christian principle as a third party?
You're asking me what amounts to a logistic question as to what would be the most effective way to bring these things about. And I just have to admit I'm up in the air on that. I see some real disadvantages of a Christian party. Let me tell you one of them. It's the same disadvantage of Christians having Christian bumper stickers. I'll tell you one reason why I don't put a bumper sticker on my car. I mean, it's not just the fact that I don't like to mess up the bumper of my car. But I know my sins when it comes to driving a car. And I'd hate to have somebody looking at that and say, well, that's what Christians do, you know? Look at that guy. You know, he's speeding on the highway. We can laugh about it, but realistically, if a Christian party were to be developed, just think of the insult it would be to the cause of Christ if this party didn't really have its act together. And right now, I'm not so sure we could mount a Christian party that we could have much confidence in. In one sense, that's down the road if it's anywhere. My duty right now, I feel, is as a professor, is trying to educate people to think as Christians in politics. And for the time being, you simply have to do the best you can with that which is available. But I would love to see my children and my grandchildren grow up in an environment where a Christian political option is a lot more feasible because we've been educating the minds of the young to think more in lines with the Bible. So I'm not advocating a Christian political party right now. I just don't know how we can best achieve it. And when it comes to logistics, I haven't worked out a lot of details. I'm really a man who deals with principles. That doesn't mean that I'm only on paper, however. I think people realize that I'm engaged in a lot of things in a practical way, but none of them amount to a Christian political party yet.
I would just like to illustrate that the church is not ready.
Oh,
yes. It wasn't until last night that I knew that there were three kinds of rights. All my life I have mastered to get it.
Mm-hmm.
And tonight with all my being, I see them as distinct and clear and life and death issues.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been reading in this area. I mean, I've been lecturing in this area. So I just want to say, for one voice, I don't think I'm ready.
Yeah.
I don't want to set the model for anybody at this point. But I'm optimistic that this lectureship and the kinds of things we're doing is in the right direction.
Okay. Thank you very much. We all have to recognize we're just way down the road from being able to do very much. Okay. I'm not going to get very much in on the rest of this lecture if I don't get started here. So unless somebody's going to be cut off, and I don't want, especially if you have criticisms, I don't want to cut you off. But unless you have that burning desire to get it in, I would like to take the last 10 minutes and try to finish part of my lecture. Okay. As I've been saying, the issue becomes, how does one discern God's will for the state? We may all grant in principle, you have to have a regulative principle, but what does the principle state? How do you know? How do you discern God's will for the state? I want to start delineating different answers to this question. First of all, there are those who say that in the New Testament, it is not easy to discern the workings of God through a specific nation, as we discern the workings of God through Old Testament Israel, even though God continues providentially to rule over political entities through his Son. It's still hard to see what nation and what activities of the nation are honoring to God. And in fact, people holding this view would say it is a mark of piety not to know where God is explicitly working. For where God is working in politics, that is a matter consigned completely to his secret, decretive will. There are some people who say God's will for the state is only a matter of providence, a matter of how he is governing the nations by his Son, by his secret will. Now, lest you think nobody really holds that view, what do you think the view of the Lutherans who submitted to Hitler's tyranny was? Their view was that Romans 13 said that the state is ordained of God. In some way, the state is really restraining evil and honoring the good, even though it's hard to see. Even though it's a deformed state, it's better than no state at all, and therefore we have to submit to God's secret will. We have to submit to any ruler that be. In God's providence, we've been given a Hitler, we've been given a Mussolini, and we have to do what they say. And there are still people today who say that, still evangelicals who say that, who still believe Romans 13 casts the blanket of God's endorsement over any power whatsoever. Okay, now in the early days of the counterculture, where there was resistance of the draft, resistance of the war in Vietnam, any number of things, none of which I'm necessarily endorsing, but in those days, the church immediately rose up in defense of our society by citing Romans 13. And I'm saying those who did so usually did so in terms of the secret will of God. It's not your job to decide what's right and wrong for the state. It's only your job to submit. It's God's secret will. And of course, the question here is, how does one discern God's will for the state? See the word that's been circled on the board? Secret. These people are saying it's a secret. It's God's secret will. It's his decretive will. It's his providence that counts. And therefore, although God judges rulers in a mysterious way, the actually existing powers are condoned by Christ. They are condoned by Paul. And we may not pry into God's providence. We may not ask about legitimate and illegitimate government. I'm sorry to have to put that view on the board because I think it's pretty far of the mark. But nevertheless, it's a view that is quite common. My answer to that is that the Bible does give us examples and guidance for civil disobedience. Remember how Peter said we must obey God rather than men? How John condones resistance of the beast by those who keep the faith of Jesus and the commandments of God. So the Bible does show us examples and gives us guidance for civil disobedience. And so Christians who are longing for the kingdom of God must aggressively critique the status quo. It is never, never acceptable for a Christian that something is being done and therefore it's right. Never acceptable that it may be our tradition. The status quo must aggressively be critiqued, I think. I'd like to give you just a short history of power versus justice in the political arena. Because you see, this is really, this view amounts to saying what counts in the state is power, not justice. In the Roman Empire, in the Holy Roman Empire, and in the Chinese Middle Kingdom, you'll notice in history, all three of these were characterized by a strong, centralized, organizing power which forcefully precluded a multicultured world. These were all cultures that imposed uniformity and prevented diversity or a multicultured world. Okay, so here you have power as central power, centralizing power, uniformity. Now, in Machiavelli and after, in terms of the history of political thought, the state is seen in essence as power. The very essence of the state becomes power. And you'll find that, for instance, in the writings of Hobbes and the Leviathan,
if you want to do some reading. But certainly politics is more than power, because politics includes a goal that is to be achieved by means of power. It involves a goal that and a means guided by justice to reach that goal. Well, let's go on in our historical survey very quickly, only a thumbnail sketch. In the era of nationalism following the Middle Ages and Machiavelli and the early days of the Renaissance, the era of nationalism, 400 years ago or so, new nationalities emerged which aimed to advance the needs and wants of a particular people. Okay, in the era of nationalism, you see state power being used to advance the needs of particular people. Power to particular people is what it amounts to. Okay, and so you have the needs of Frenchmen or the needs of Spaniards or the needs of the Portuguese being advanced in the name of the state, in the name of power. Well, now you come down a little bit further and you come to the French Revolution, and you see that the meaning and the aim of power there is egalitarianism, the leveling of all distinctions. Okay? In the name of power, you have the centralizing state. You have the state, which by its very essence is power. You have power for particular people. You have power for leveling distinctions so that there's no longer any difference between people, egalitarianism. And then you have the Russian Revolution, finally, in the course of human events. And what's the Russian Revolution aiming at? It uses power in order, ideally, to put away all power. What am I suggesting the lesson of history is? That when you see power, and simply power, as the essence of the state, and no further qualifications, it becomes self-destructive. Not only can you not tell what the nature of that power is, but in the course of events, it moves eventually to the destruction of all power. Power used for the sake of destroying power, or the state used for the sake of destroying all states. And so we cannot avoid, even if you don't like everything I said before, historically you can't avoid asking the question, how should power be used? And when you say, how should power be used, you're asking the question of justice. What should the state be doing? What makes the use of power legitimate? What are the norms for the state's coercion? What standards govern the use of the sword? Okay. This by way of critique, then, of the idea that we don't look for God's will that regulates the state. We don't want to pry because it's only his secret will that counts, providence. That is to say, the power of the state. We've run out of time. Tell you what, I'm just going to say very quickly what the next view is so you have something to be working on when we come back. I'm sorry for the break tomorrow night. I'd really like to get through this, but on Thursday, when we come back, I'll have to complete this portion of our lecturing. There are those who go to the very opposite extreme. These people say, don't ask questions about justice. It's only God's secret will that counts, and therefore we don't pry. There are those who go to the other extreme who say, whatever is happening in the state, we may baldly and without reluctance, without qualification, identify secular movements with the political work of Christ. Whatever, as a matter of fact, is happening is the will of God. And you see this in current liberation theology, in certain political theological movements, and you certainly see it in the 1976 Boston Affirmation, which I will read selectively for you when we come back. Here the idea is that God's will is discerned wherever things are happening. That, of course, is the colloquial expression. Usually, wherever things are happening for the breaking down of barriers and the lifting up of the oppressed in rhetoric such as that. Wherever things are happening, that's where God's will is to be discerned. Okay, so is our society opposing the war in Vietnam? That's God's will. Is our society trying to do away with nuclear power plants? That's God's will. So forth. Wherever the poor are being lifted up, the oppressed are being lifted up, wherever barriers are being broken down, wherever things are happening, that's God's will. You remember Harvey Cox? You all do, right? God's kingdom is where it's happening. That's right. Okay, we'll come back on Thursday night and continue going through. We'll come to some more credible views in time.
This recording has been released into the public domain by the Bonson Institute. Duplication, sharing, and distribution is encouraged. For more information about the life and ministry of Dr. Greg L. Bonson, visit our website, bonsoninstitute.com, where we aim to bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ.